Well, if you asked any Bible teachers, Bible scholar, the top five chapters in the Bible, there might be some differences. They would all agree that Genesis 12 is in the top five. It might be higher, top three. I don't know how you exactly classify those, but in terms of foundational for everything that comes after, Genesis 12 is critical. And to say, too, whatever chapters you would pick after Genesis 12, to say, well, that's one of the most important chapters, Isaiah 53 or John 3 or whatever you might choose, Psalm 110, they are all built on, based on Genesis 12, because everything in the Bible goes back to the Abrahamic covenant. So, today we are going to be looking not just at the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12, but Abrahamic covenant throughout Abraham's life, so, which is like 13 chapters. Hold on for the ride. And then next week is going to be the Abrahamic covenant in the lives of the patriarchs. Abraham's a patriarch, but in the other patriarchs. So Isaac and Jacob and their sons, the 12 sons of Jacob. So this is very, very important, very interesting. And one of the things I hope you see today, too, you will see this, is that, and I've said this before, but I won't tire of saying it because I think it's just a plague of the church, and that is the Bible is not composed of isolated stories. It's not, there aren't standalone chapters any more than this week I read, my son Mark, 8th grade, has this English class. I went open house and I was there. I was just like, wow, this is a great teacher. She's got a great curriculum. And so I wrote her a letter and said, yeah, I'm going to buy the book so Mark and I can read them together. And so this week I read Agatha Christie, a novel, And Then There Were None. And great, fun little story. Of course, 20 deaths. But you can't just pull a chapter out of the middle there and expect to understand. You can't start in the middle. And so, too, with Abraham, if you just say, and like we do, this is the way we teach Sunday school, how kids start off is, okay, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, well, they may not do that one. The story of Abraham lying to the Pharaoh. Don't lie. There's more going on there. Okay, so that's the introduction. I'm going to move now through. We're going to go through. The plan here, the hope, dream, is to race through chapter 12 through 24. I know I asked you to read through 22, and then as I was studying, I just said I need to change the boundaries. So, so we're going to specifically look at, it's not, I don't want to call it the life of Abraham. Someone writes a book called The Life of Abraham. That's not really right, because there's not the life of Abraham in the Bible. There's God's, here's what I would call Genesis 12 to 24. Instead of calling it the life of Abraham, I call it the outworking of God's promise to Abraham. Now that doesn't sound as cute, won't make for such a good book title as The Life of Abraham, but it's not the life of Abraham. We don't know all kinds of things about his life. The writer is not interested in his life. The writer is interested in how God is going to do what he said he would do, and it is amazing. So we're going to start in chapter 12. We're going to spend a little more time in chapter 12. In fact, the first page of your handout is about chapter 12. And you really have to get this right. By the way, I do have enough handouts for every single person. Okay. So if you didn't get one and you want one, there's actually a whole lot of them, because some people cut class today. Oh, it's too bad. It's so critical. It's not just critical, it's fun. I mean, I was just having a ball going through this. And it's not the first time I've studied this, but there are still so many things. It is the first time I've ever taught this. Everything we're doing is from scratch. I mean, this is all If it feels fresh, it's because it is fresh. I'm not pulling anything out of the can here. But so Genesis 12, God calls Abraham. And I'm going to try to avoid things you know already, just to save time. And I also will use the name Abraham and Abraham interchangeably, so don't get hung up on that. But God calls Abraham and says, the first three verses, there's four things, or let's go with three. Three things, one of them has two parts, that God promises to Abraham. And a teacher once helped me remember this for the rest of my life. He said, you just remember the acronym LSB. And I never forgot. LSB, like the drug, kind of, is land, seed, blessing. That's what's going on. Those are the three elements of the Abrahamic covenant. And I don't even know if I like the word covenant. It is a covenant, but we often think of a covenant as two parties agreeing. Abraham wasn't agreeing. I mean, it was pretty much God just saying, I will. This is a unilateral, I will do this. Now, I'm not saying Abraham had no part. Abraham did obey. He did choose to leave and come to the land of Canaan. He did choose to circumcise his son. I mean, there's a relationship, there's a loyalty there, but the covenant does not hang on Abraham's actions. Now, in the first three verses of Genesis 12, I will make you into a great nation. We are going to watch that happen in the book of Genesis. How is God going to make Abraham into a great nation? Actually, by the end of Genesis, we have a big family. We have 70 people. But you'll turn the page into Exodus, you have a great nation. Okay, it's a lot of people. Is it a nation? It's kind of getting there. They don't have a land. God says, I'm going to give you a land. That's going to be in verse 7. I will bless you. I'll make your name great. If you read this isolated, then you won't appreciate the contrast from last chapter. What are the people of Tower of Babel doing? Everybody gets caught up in what's the tower look like? How high was it? Are they really going to like reach the... Forget that. The point with Tower of Babel is the people want to make their name great as opposed to God. And they don't want God to make their name great. They want to make their name great. And God's saying, look, those guys can be scattered to the winds. I will make your name great. So he says to Abraham, and you will be a blessing. This is very important. Maybe the most important part of it is, yes, I'm going to give you a seed. I'm going to give you a land. Why? Both of these things, the land and the seed, are for the blessing. What blessing? So Israel's blessed and the rest of the world's cursed? No. All families will be blessed through you. That was God's plan from the very beginning. The world is under a curse with the fall. God's going to restore creation. God's going to restore the... How's he going to do it? Well, didn't quite work with Noah. You know, the flood and that. No, I'm not saying God failed at what he tried. I'm saying the way that God intended to do it was that he would choose one man and his barren wife. It's a very ominous note at the end of chapter 11. It says, and his wife Sarah was barren. So you need to read the whole story on the edge of your seat saying, wait a second, she's barren and I'm going to make you into a great nation. Like, that's not going to happen. So, I mean, really, this story, you need to read it. And we don't read it on the edge of our seats because we already know the answer. We think we do. Just tragic. You need to try to read the Bible as if you forget everything that's coming after, so you are on the edge of your seat, and so you go slow and you pay attention, as you should in an Agatha Christie novel, to the details. Why do we think that mystery novel writers are so much smarter than God in the Bible? I mean, the way we kind of pay attention to detail, whereas in the Bible we can sometimes just kind of, oh, it's a story and, you know, what happens next, and I don't need the dialogue part. You know, whatever God says, yeah, he says these. I mean, as I mentioned to you before, the dialogue, what God says, we really need to have, we know we have the red letter in the New Testament, we really need to have the yellow highlighted in the old. And what God says, highlight that, slow down, that's where everything turns. So let me just crystallize this, and I am blowing through here, but verse 7 says, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your seed I will give this land. That captures a lot right there. Abraham's now in the land of Canaan. He's at Shechem. Who was at Shechem with me a few months ago? Yes, good memories. Abraham's there at Shechem, and God says, to your seed, I'm going to use the word seed instead of descendants or offspring, because that's the most direct translation, and because it leaves open the possibility of different understanding. So is it, you? Because every time the reader in the Hebrew, and when Abraham was hearing it for the first time, they have to say, well, what do you mean by seed? We need to ask that ourselves. What do you mean by seed? Do you mean, because sometimes it does, a lot of descendants, like the stars of the sky or the dust of the earth? Or does it mean an individual? Because sometimes it means an individual. You have to ask that question, and it may not always be clear. And sometimes that question is answered as you go further on in Revelation. So I'm going to use the word seed. To your land, or to your seed, I will give this land. Why? To bless the world. And if you think ahead, you know how that's going to play out. Right? You know who the seed is. Most particularly, actually, let me get ahead of myself. But this is how it plays out, right? We have a seed, capital S, Jesus, King Jesus, ruling over the seed of Abraham, that is the descendants of Abraham, who are living in faith, like the faith of Abraham, on earth. That's the ultimate blessing the nations who are not in that physical seed. That's, we call it the kingdom or the millennium. But that's where this is all going to go. But let's come back now to chapter 12. So what I did in the handout, and I asked Kelly, I said, this is a struggle I have as a teacher in college, is I don't like giving out the answers, as it were. Like my conclusions, my summary, before I teach, because then I feel like they'll just tune out. So I don't want you to tune out, but I thought it might be helpful just to kind of have a summary in your hand. You don't have to write it all down, and also because I know I won't have time for everything. But what I did in a handout in the middle of two pages is to just go through and to give you my understanding of what each episode is about, and the key thing. It's not about lying. It's not even about, you know, taking a second wife. So that I did try to summarize it, but I'm gonna walk through it here orally. Now, when Abraham goes to Egypt, the end of chapter 12. Now, no, you just stop. Wait a second. There's a famine in the land. Stop right there. What should Abram do? That's right. He should seek God's will. God told him, leave your land and go to the land I will give you. And so what does Abraham do when there's a famine? He leaves. Like, that's wrong. Right there, the reader needs to go, uh-oh, bad things coming. Abraham's not walking with God. Abraham went down to live there for a while because the famine was severe. By the way, you'll contrast this. There's a lot of connections. I don't have time to make them all. But when you, next week, when you read that there's a famine in the land, and Isaac is tempted to go to Egypt, God says, no, don't go. I think there God may know, I could be wrong, that Isaac's faith might have been a little bit weaker, and it could have caused longer, bigger problems. And so God just says, no, we're not even going to get to go there that time. You stay here. But then with Jacob, Jacob's afraid to go to Egypt. And God appears to him and says, nope, it's my will. Go to Egypt, and I'll bring you back. Which he'd already told to Jacob's grandfather, Abraham. He'd already said, you're going to go to an Egypt and live there 400 years. So, but what I want you to do as you read through the life of Abraham is to be reading all of it in light of God's promise to Abraham. Read all of it. So when he leaves the land, you say, uh-oh. When it says he told his wife through whom we're going to have a great nation. Oh, I guess you can go and be Pharaoh's wife. Like, is that jeopardizing the seed? I mean, she's supposed to be the one who has your child, but you're giving her to the Pharaoh so that the integrity of that line is now jeopardized in a few ways. So, but
the integrity of Abraham.
Well, yeah, he already blew that. But and then what happens? The Lord, verse 17. The Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh. Here's what's going on here. Besides, it's two things. It's God protecting the seed, yes, and it's Pharaoh who had dishonored Abraham. And that's probably a better way to translate back in verse 3. Whoever curses you, I will curse. They're not the same word for curse. So it's not, you don't say, well, I'm not going to be cursed because I didn't like provoke or speak a malediction. You know, I didn't like say, oh, curse you. That's not. Anyone who dishonors Abraham or doesn't esteems him lightly or will be cursed. So what is Pharaoh doing? I mean, he's taking Abraham's wife. He's dishonoring him. Now you say, well, there's some lack of knowledge. And okay, in a sense, it doesn't matter. God punishes Pharaoh for his treatment of Abraham. So we're seeing the blessings and the curse. Later on, by the way, in contrast, in chapter 20, remember, it happens again. And the critical scholars who have no imagination. Should we open the door?
Yeah.
Welcome.
Good morning. I'm so sorry. I'm too late.
You're welcome. We have a seat for you. The scholars who don't believe the Bible and who have no imagination will say, the story in chapter 20 in which Abraham lies about his wife again to Abimelech, well, it's just a doublet. It's just a repeat. It's no, not at all. There's some very significant differences. And one of those differences is Abimelech is very different. Pharaoh is, I think, wicked in the way he acts. Abimelech, his response in the way is very righteous, and actually he's blessed because of the way that unfolds. So you can compare and contrast. That's an important thing too. You see, especially in the Old Testament, we see a good bit in Genesis, some repetition, duplication, some people, you know. When you see that, one, there may be an idea of emphasis, but the other is you can compare and contrast. Like, you know, what's different this time? Because that is being emphasized. All right, we're still in chapter 12. So we've got to get out. We're in the 13 now. So what's going on in chapter 13, Abraham and Lot? Well, one thing about Lot is, like, why does Lot even need to be here? Abraham has 318 men, and he's got all kinds of people. Like, how does Lot function in this story? And it's not an issue of him being there. You say, well, he was there, so they write. No. There's a lot of people who are there, and they don't put him in the narrative. Why does the writer want you to see Lot? Well, I think one of the reasons is Lot's a nephew, and he's not a son. So that he's kind of a reminder, like, oh yeah, Abraham, you don't have a son. You're interacting with your nephew, who's not of you. He's not of your seed. Then another thing is the contrast between righteous living and unrighteous living. Lot, when Lot chooses, Abraham says, you can pick your place. Lot should, by the way, have said, no, you're the elder, you get to choose. Lot should have deferred. He doesn't do that. And then when Lot chooses, what is he? He says, he looks down and he sees the land that he's going to pick. It says, it's like the land of Egypt. Wait a second. That's a bad sign right there. And then you follow through, the story. You see how Lot clearly he chooses the cities, and two. When you see the word city throughout the narratives, it's always associated with something bad. When Abraham goes into the city of Gerar, then he lies about his wife, and she's taken by Abimelech. When of course the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. their wickedness and it's going to be destroyed. And there's just a number of places in there where it's not that God's against cities per se. In fact, in Hebrews it says that Abraham looked forward to a city from heaven. But cities like the Tower of Babel, the problem there was they're gathering together in unity against God. It can be a marker like that's not a good thing. So a couple things with Lot here is, or maybe beyond what I just said, I want to just say that Lot's choice gets him out of the promised land. That's one of the things going on there. In fact, you watch that throughout Genesis. You see separation. You see distinguishing. You see God choosing him and not him, right? Jacob and not Esau, Isaac and not Ishmael. And in each of those cases, with Ishmael and with Esau, and here with Lot, very clearly, they leave the land that God has promised to Abraham. So it can belong to Abraham. Abraham doesn't ever have to fight one of his relatives for the land. The Ammonites, descendant of Lot, and Moabites both, are outside of the land God promised to him. The Esau, very clearly in the end of Genesis 33, goes and lives outside the land. So God's kind of kept family out of the land and says, so who's living in the land that God's going to give to Abraham? The land of Canaan, it belongs to the Canaanites. Who are the Canaanites? They're the descendants of Canaan, the son of Ham. Remember the sin last week in Genesis 9. All this ties together. Was there a hand?
Yeah. Actually, you know, since Abraham wasn't supposed to take Lot, Lot is never happy. I mean, he's always given. Did it ever occur to Lot that all this, to Abraham, that he should have taken Lot and all this unhappiness and trying to satisfy Lot?
It's
kind of, it's a sin, but it's just, it stayed with him.
Well, God told Abraham to
right, it says leave your father's household. Yeah, and so maybe I want to be a little careful on that and just say, oh, you're that was wrong, because God's not against foreigners. He's not people who say this way. Those who want to change sides, join God's team, who want to bless Abraham, who want to, like Abimelech does in chapter 20, great illustration of what a foreigner, chapter 20 and 21, 21 more, of how foreigners, non-seed, non-Israelites, should relate to them, because they're supposed to bless the world. So, I would say it this way. If, at the very beginning, when God says, Abraham, leave, if Lot had said, no, Abraham, your God is my God, and I'm going to follow faithfully, then I think Abraham was justified in doing it. There's no indication that Lot thought that way, because everything we see later on is Lot is not pursuing Abraham's way. So, that's a good point that I hadn't thought through. Chapter 14. Well, I have to skip things here. So what do I skip? You know, this chapter is going to be critical in laying Psalm 110, one of the most important psalms in the Bible, Psalm 110, where you have the priest in the order of Melchizedek, and then how that's developed in Hebrews. And I assume you've heard that somewhere else, so I can probably skip it. But here, I'll say this about chapter 14. Maybe I'll make... Oh, yeah, it's massively important. I'm skipping it because I think you know about it. What did you ask?
Yeah, I was asking what is it. I've heard it all these years, but what? I think Jesus Christ himself even brought that up. Why is that so important?
We need a lesson. And Jeff's going to be getting to 110. Next week he's in Psalm 90. I don't know what he's got between 90 and 110. He may be at 110 in 2 weeks. Here's how it relates to Genesis 14. Abraham has a great victory. He defeats five king coalition, which basically script is portraying Abraham as a king himself. Not in name, he's not wearing a crown, but he's functioning as a leader of a group of people, and he's defending his future land from these invaders. And after he has the victory, he goes to Melchizedek, or Melchizedek comes to him, and there's this encounter at a place we later know as Jerusalem. Salem is Jerusalem. And Abraham gives tithes, 10% of all that he collected, to the king and priest of Jerusalem, which is a way of saying, you're greater than me. That is to say, you're God, there's me, Abraham, and God, and in between is Melchizedek. So I can give to God through Melchizedek, as it were. So Melchizedek is superior. That's going to be the argument for Jesus, because Jesus is of the line of Judah. He can't be a priest. He's not a priest of a Levite priest. He's a, what kind of priest is he? He's a priest like Melchizedek, who is superior to Levi, because Levi was the great-grandson of Abraham. Did that follow?
Yeah, I'm glad you kind of explained it. It's pretty complex.
It's very, very interesting and very important. And but I think I'll just wrap it up by saying important point here is that Melchizedek blesses Abraham, and that's another thing too, is the superior blesses the lesser. And so that's another reflection. But it's, he says, Melchizedek says, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High. Blessed be God Most High who delivered your enemies into your hand." So the victory that Abraham had as this king, effectively, was given to him by God, which is the model for Joshua, David, all those guys. Should do it like Abraham. God will give you the victory as you trust in Him. You only have 318 men. You can defeat five kings. Chapter 15 is huge in the development of the Abrahamic covenant. Chapter 15, the Lord appears to Abraham. And you know, like verse 6, you're very familiar with verse 6. I'm going to skip it entirely right now. What is God doing? And I've skipped over some of this. Some of it's in your notes. But from chapter in 12, and then in 13, and now in 15, again in 17, and then in 22, God is going to be developing the promise. He's going to be expanding, by which I mean giving more detail. So before he says, "Abraham, to your seed I will give this land." What seed? What land? We find that in chapter 13, God says, "Abraham, I'm going to give you the land of Canaan. Walk about it." And the walking about is a sign that, that it's yours. Like you're marking your territories in a way. What seed, what land? At the end of chapter 15, he's going to say, here are the borders of the land. From this river to that river, Euphrates, to the river of Egypt, which is not the Nile. It's the river on the eastern side of Egypt. Probably what's known today as the Wadi El-Arish. So between those rivers, that's going to be your land. So he's defining the land increasingly. He's defining the seed. What seed? You're going to see chapter 16. No, not that seed. Not Ishmael. Because he's the son of the slave woman. But here's a better way to say it. I want to come back to 15. But well, 16, what's the problem there with Hagar and Abraham? You say, hey, it's Abraham's seed. Like, one woman, another woman, why not? And in fact, it even uses the word wife there. Like, okay, so why not? I mean, Jacob has two wives, and God doesn't, like, throw him out. It's the word promise. God says to Abraham, I will make you into a great nation. And what happened with Hagar was Abraham did. Abraham and Sarah, and I'm going to get in trouble here from half the class, but you have a number of cases in the book of Genesis and beyond where when a woman asserts the rule in the home, things don't go as they should. Now, that doesn't mean there's not a zillion times where men are doing their leading and messing everything up too, to be sure, but I think it goes back to Genesis 3:16, where your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you, is where you have an inversion. And so Sarah comes to Abram and says, you know what, look, we need to solve this problem. God says he's going to give you seed, so I'm not going to have any babies. You need to do this. So she shouldn't have taken that lead, I would suggest. It's not the most important point, probably. But then Abraham, like Adam, says, oh, yeah, good idea. Let's do that. And no, it's a wretched idea, the problems of which are still with us until yesterday, today. Which is not to say that God does not intend to bless the descendants of Ishmael. Through Abraham, he will. Today, through our missionaries who go out and tell them the good news of the seed of Jesus, who died for them. So, and in fact, I'm not just speaking very abstractly. God blesses Ishmael. So it's not like, so we got to be careful here in how we talk about things. But God does, and this is a distinction. God can bless Ishmael, but say he's not the covenant child. He's the natural child. He was born naturally. There was no miracle there. That wasn't the result of a promise. That was the result of your scheme, of your plot. That's the child of works. No, you're going to have a child of promise. You're going to have a child that's the fulfillment of my promise to give you a seed through your wife. What else here in chapter 15 I must say? Oh, yes. The ceremony. This strange Abraham, the sun's going down, Abraham goes to sleep, and before Abraham went to sleep, he got some animals, he cut them in half, and then he walked through the middle, in the vision, God, actually depicted as a fire pot, passes through the middle of the animals, and you go like, whatever, I don't understand that. And you don't, because when you go to buy a car or you sign your deed on your house or whatever, you don't do that. We don't do contracts that way. We do other things. We have notaries and signatures and all that. But back then, that's the way they did a covenant. What it symbolized, and if you don't believe me, look up Jeremiah 34:18, because it says it explicitly there. And this was just known in the ancient world that the cutting of animals and the passing through them, whoever passed through was saying, I will do what I have said I will do at the penalty of having this done to me. You cut me in half. The most important thing about the vision is who doesn't pass through. Abraham doesn't. The covenant is not dependent upon Abraham. God will fulfill it. God will do what he said. He will make his name great, give him a seed, land, he's going to bless the world, even if Abraham is unfaithful, and we see he is. God steps in and protects him, blesses him. I might say a word, too, just about, say, how do these unconditional covenants work? Because that just means like God's always, there is an aspect of, more than an aspect, of the descendants of Abraham who do not embrace the way of Abraham. That doesn't void God's covenant. It cuts them off from the blessings of God's covenant. So they don't participate in the blessings of the covenant. I think that's 15. I kind of talked about 16. Oh boy. Chapter 17. 15 and 17 really go together. They're both expansions of the covenant, the promise. There's a few new things in 17. One of them is God says, I'm going to make you the father of nations, plural, and kings will come from you. He's going to be the father of a nation. The nation's going to have kings. And that's going to tie in. We're going to see some things later on. Well, just next week in Genesis 49, Judah is promised the kingly rule, right? You know how that's going to go down ultimately to Jesus. So there's some hints. There's some suggestions here. The circumcision is a sign that you're in the covenant. It's a sign that says we accept that we're part of that covenant. We want to. We're gonna. And if you don't, conversely, he who doesn't have the sign of circumcision is outside of the covenant, cut off. Okay, I've got to skip. I'm going to skip 18 and 19. I wrote a little bit about it in the notes.
I have a little question for you. The Jews in Israel still do the circumcision. Do they do
it? Absolutely. It's critical. The home. Yeah, it's like a birthday party or a wedding. I mean, they'll have a big, if they've got 100 people coming, they'll rent out a hall or something like that.
What's wrong with the hospital?
Because here's why, it is one of the most important life ceremonies. It's like a wedding for us. I mean, their weddings are big too, so it's not in place, but it's not a medical procedure like it is in the States. It's not something about, we hear you have less diseases or whatever. No, this is like you're in the covenant. And even if they're not religious, it's just so bound up with being Jewish. Well, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of modern, liberal, so I don't know that all. But I know, which other story I want to tell you. Jews who live in Dallas, can go. There's a doctor. He flies in once a week, out of his parents' house, and he just does circumcisions all day. Yeah, they're just coming in every 20 minutes. Yeah.
Just to go to 22, as I know you're trying to wrap up, and it talks about 22 talks about the end. The Bible talks about the sacrifice that Abraham, Isaac, and going up to the mountain with the ram and everything. I understand now. Why that was important, because Abraham wasn't really hanging on to the promises. He was struggling with it the whole time through his whole life. And so really, this is a test. This isn't about Abraham having a halo over his head and going, well, you got to sacrifice your son for me. No, it's not the issue. It's like, are you trustworthy? Can I trust you to do the promise?
This is massive. The significance of Genesis 22, which is in the Jewish list of most important chapters in the Bible, 22 would easily be in the top five. The test of Abraham, genuinely reveals Abraham's deep, deep faith, which wasn't always the case. You can trace through Abraham. He's got faith when he starts. God says, leave and come to Canaan, and he does. But then it's like, go to Egypt, sleep with Hagar. There's ups and downs. But in 22, at the end, he hits a home run grand slam. I mean, it's not just, well, I love my, it's not, you say, well, put yourself in your own shoes. Forget that. It's not putting yourself, you say, but I only have one, you're not in the same category. This is the promised child that God's going to fulfill his promises through. It's none of us are in that category. So for Abraham to say, God, I waited for this for decades. Am I going to trust you for this? That I could, and Hebrews says, Hebrews nails it exactly right. Of course, I'm talking about the Bible. But Abraham, God will raise him from the dead. I'm just going to do it. I think that Isaac probably should get a little more credit than he does, because he's old enough to carry a lot of wood on his back. So he knows Dad got the wood ready, got the fire ready, got the knife ready, got all these things. For 3 days we're walking along, we don't have a lamb. And Isaac knows, like, something's missing here. But only on the third day he asks, Dad. And then he gets up on the altar. Abraham's 100 years old, 100, probably 10, 15 years old. Isaac, I think, could fight and get away. But it's the focus in the narrative there is not on Isaac. But I've got to end. I'll tell you that the purchase of the plot for Sarah, you say, well, that, why does that take the whole chapter? I mean, like, just say buried her and move on. It's the first piece of land Abraham owned. One day he's going to own it all, but that's the first piece. And by the way, too, you say, well, all that discussion, the negotiation, and go look, if Abraham had taken that as a gift, the claim would be shaky. But he's, no, I paid full price. maybe a little bit extra. I own it. Let's pray. Father, you know how wonderful the story is. I mean, you lived through, you know, you talked to just the glory of this all as it was happening, as you watched Abraham's faith grow, as you heard the question, which is just reverberated throughout the centuries: is anything too hard for the Lord? And these tests, these lessons, and how valuable they've been to so many faithful over these years and to us today. And so we just conclude here by thanking you for being absolutely faithful. I mean, that's kind of crazy because that's just bound up in your character. You can't have anything else but faithful. But in a world where everything and everyone is faithless, we are so drawn to, attracted to, and deeply thankful for your absolutely 100% of the time faithful character, faithful to all of your promises, faithful to Abraham day in and day out, faithful to us. And so, Lord, that's what where we need help is our faith falters like Abraham's. Our faith is sometimes too weak. We're tempted to rely on ourselves and not trust your promise, not take you at your word, to doubt you. And Lord, this is wicked. It is tragic. It is sad. And so we want to see that more clearly, Lord. We want you to reveal that our weak faith. We want you to help us to see that for what it is, so that we can repent of it and trust you fully. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.